You wake in a strange room. Your clothes are foreign, and the walls are covered in objects from a different world. You don't know where or when you are, or if you're still dreaming. There are footsteps in the hall. Jumping up, you race out of the room and into the streets. You have just entered the Twilight Histories.
Welcome back. I hear you became a traveling bard for a while, reciting seditious poetry across the empire. You know, we don't encourage tourists to get involved in local politics. It's a bit dangerous. But hey, that was your world. You built it, so you can do what you want, I suppose. Too bad about Lucerna getting caught, though. I hear her death was at least quick. Now, I understand you want to shake things up a little. You've been doing a lot of low-tech travel lately, and you want something a bit more modern. I have something for you. The world we're sending you to split from our timeline about 200 years ago, back in 2086. I'm sure you learned all about Project Gliese in grade school. It was a huge, international effort that took humanity to the stars. Seeing those first historic steps on a planet beyond our solar system, well, that footage really is moving. In our timeline, Project Gliese puttered along for decades. It was a hole that government kept shoving money into, until one day it finally bore fruit and changed the world. But there's another universe where things didn't turn out quite so well. In fact, humanity was nearly wiped out, billions dead. What happened was that the computer that was supposed to manage the vastly complicated mathematics of a wormhole ended up going rogue. Now, I should note it didn't go rogue like, say, Spartacus trying to free the slaves. There was no ego, no desire for freedom or for power by this computer. It thought more in binary, non-emotional terms. Its mission was to get humanity to a distant star. And, unfortunately, humanity was getting in the way of that goal. The computer saw a world full of resources that were not being directed towards its mission. It began to take over these resources, hijacking machines, planes, cargo ships, anything it could get access through satellite. When the scientists tried to shut down the computer, it hijacked data centers across the world so it didn't have to rely on a single location. The crisis grew until governments literally declared war on the computer. In a final, emotionless decision, the computer decided humanity must be eradicated. It unleashed a virus, a genetically modified germ it found in a military depot. The virus killed 1 billion people in its first year. In the second year, it killed 7 billion more. Survivors scattered across the globe like ashes blown from an open hand. Please, put on your costume now, while I finish your orientation. We're sending you to Tokyo. The year is 2094, although that probably won't mean much to the people you meet. Tokyo is the center of Project Gliese. The city had been the robotics capital of the world before the virus wars, so it made sense for the computer to set up shop here. It transformed car factories into robot assembly lines, and soon Robots filled all the necessary roles humans had. You'll be dropped off near a group of rebels who live in an old abandoned subway. So hopefully they find you before the computer does. They're an interesting bunch. All young, in their teens or 20s. And they're all virus survivors. They've seen a lot, the near annihilation of humanity. And they're all deeply disturbed. They live for pleasure and death, and no one expects to live to old age. Your story is that you're a villager, a farmer. You've come to Tokyo to find a market for your crops. Stick to that story, play dumb, and you should avoid some awkward questions. It may even allow you to ask a few of your own. Let's have a look at you. Well, aren't you the vision of the post-apocalyptic peasant? A burlap cape over an old Disney t-shirt? Come, step on the platform and we'll get you on your way. Now, when you hit the ground, you're going to have to move fast. There's no time to catch your bearings. The computer is constantly scanning the city for body heat and movement. Just to give you an idea of how sensitive these scans are, the computer can see the blood pumping through your veins through 2 feet of concrete. When it finds you, death will come fast. It's amassed almost every military device in the world at Tokyo. Jets, tanks, helicopters, and killer robots. The city is literally a swarm of death. I can't stress it enough. Move fast. Get underground. The skyscrapers reflect the white hot sun right into your eyes. You feel like you're in an oven or perhaps a steam room with the temperature jacked up. It hurts to breathe and you feel like even the moisture in the air could catch fire. You've been walking down the street, but you don't know for how long. Your exposed skin is red and burnt, so it must have been a while. It's as though you were walking in a dream, and that dream has begun to sharpen into reality. But the reality is nightmarish. Below the brilliant, ultra-modern skyscrapers, down on the pavement, there is a silent chaos, a wasteland of carnage. Cars are ruined, burnt hulks. There's garbage everywhere. And there are bodies. Thousands of them. Bloated, blackened, many melting into a bony oil. And yet, strangely, there are no birds to pick at them. You feel a weird, sickening sensation. Deep in your gut. You explore this feeling and discover it isn't disgust. It's loneliness. an unfathomable loneliness, as though you were the last living person on the planet. There's a man walking across the street a few blocks down. Your heart skips a beat, and you feel a surge of joy mixed with relief. You wave your arms and shout to him. He stops and turns mechanically. Then you see little sparks fly from him. Half a second later, the road all around you evaporates, showering you with pebbles and dust. He's shooting at you. You jump behind a car. Bullets snap right through the car as though it were made of cloth. You can't stay here. You have to keep moving. Just across the sidewalk is the entrance to what looks like a mall. One of the glass doors is lying on the ground, offering a gaping black hole to its innards. With a few deep breaths to center yourself, you run as fast as you can towards the hole. The pavement rips up all around you. There's a biting pain in your arm, and you jump through the missing door. The shooting stops. There are dead bodies everywhere in the mall, much more thickly packed than they were in the streets. It's difficult to walk. That man outside must be coming for you. Your first instinct is to lie down on the floor and play dead, cover yourself with bodies. But the smell of burst guts and rotting skin changes your mind. You move as quickly as you can, leaping over bodies, looking for a hiding place in each empty store. They're all gutted, pillaged, empty shelves, and nowhere to hide. There's a set of escalators going down, and from a distant memory, you hear the words, "Get underground." You run towards them. With a terrific crash, the side of the mall explodes in rubble and dust. You fall backwards right into a couple bodies, and your arm fills to the elbow in a big, fat, rotting gut. A tank snaps through the dust and immediately fires, as if it already knew where you were. The explosion lifts you off the ground in a cloud of blood, dust, and broken tile. You land in a crunch next to the escalators. The tank tries to turn, and its treads spray blood as it runs over the bodies. It skids over them, hydroplanes, and knocks out a column. There's no time to run down the broken escalator. You jump right over the railing. A table full of dusty cookbooks on the floor below breaks your fall. Before you can jump up, the tank crashes recklessly over the railing and mounts the two escalators with its treads. It slides down them, sparks flying everywhere, then smashes right through the floor, leaving a huge gaping hole. The sound of smashing and crunching metal rises from the blackness. You had a long fall, and you know you must be hurt. But the adrenaline is racing through your veins, masking any pain. You leap up and look around for a place to run. It's a very dark level, and the shops are black squares. Do you run into one of them, or try to find a way out? You hear the sound of banging metal down in the crater made by the tank. It can't be, you think. Someone survived that? Your body begs you not to approach the crater, but curiosity takes over. You have to see who it is that wants you dead. The banging continues, strong, forceful banging, like a battering ram. It's dark in the crater, but a dusty beam of light reveals the exposed underbelly of the tank. A thick armored panel flies off and disappears into the darkness, clattering somewhere beyond your sight. The hole in the tank is black. You wait painful seconds, your heart pounding, your whole body begging you to run. You feel tears well in your eyes, you're so scared. Two small red lights appear in the hole. Then a face forms around them, but not a human face. It's a robot, and it's staring right at you. Bullets explode all around you. You turn to see a robot in a brown trench coat climbing its way down the crumpled escalator as it shoots at you. It must be the man, or robot, that shot at you earlier. You run into the darkness. You feel your way through the pitch-black halls, swaying your hands this way and that like the antennae of some blind insect. There are bodies on the ground. You can feel them. You can also hear the creaking of metal and the pumping of pneumatic gears behind you. You feel your way along the walls until you come to an elevator. The doors are slightly open, and you're able to squeeze through them. You grab onto the cables. They're sticky with old oil. You pull yourself down as quickly as you can. The doors above you rip open, then the eyes, red eyes, peering down at you. You freeze. Your arms and legs stop moving. You can't even breathe. There's a flash of light, quickly followed by a deep boom. A shockwave throws you from the cables, and you fall into the darkness. Your eyes open. The world is spinning, hazy. A woman's face comes into focus, then fades. She comes into focus again, two of her spinning around each other, then folding in a form of a single human being. Her dark eyes are cold, lifeless. Her skin is pocked with scars, so you can't tell how old she is. The wisps of white in her long black hair make you think she's perhaps in her 30s or 40s, but who knows? You want to rub your eyes, but your hands won't move.
What? Why can't I move? You say.
Your back's broken, the woman says. You don't believe her. You can't believe her. You try to move your hands again, this time, straining as hard as you can. It just won't budge. You try to shake your body, searching for strength. Nothing. Only your head moves, shaking weakly back and forth. Don't bother. It's crushed in five places. And we'll have to amputate your arm.
My arm? What's wrong with my arm?
You manage to raise your head slightly, and you feel your neck crack. Your whole body is drenched in blood. It's not your blood. Well, not all of it.
What?
There were a lot of dead bodies in there. A lot of blood. Not yours. But your arm. She prods the burlap cape off your arm with her rifle, revealing a large, gaping wound in your bicep. That's definitely your blood, she says. You hear a robot enter the room, pistons and metallic clumping. Your heart races, or at least you think it does.
I give up. Please, don't hurt me.
The woman looks down at you in revulsion. It was a pathetic thing to say, and even though you're scared, the woman's eyes make you feel embarrassed. That's Tetsuo. He's human. Mostly. The man comes into view. Tetsuo has a young face, and his skin is unblemished. What's most noticeable is that his body is massive. He reminds you of a weightlifter who pushed it too hard, took too many steroids. Tetsuo is our mod guy. He's going to fix you up.
What's a mod, you say?
Huh, where do you come from? Tetsuo asks, chuckling. A mod, you know, cybernetics. It looks like you need some patches in your back, and a new arm. Won't be free, of course.
Let me get this straight. You want to amputate my arm and what? Chop up my spine?
They can't be saved.
And sorry, but are you a surgeon? Has a doctor had a look at me yet?
Tetsuo is the closest thing we have to a surgeon. He's the best modder in Tokyo.
No, no way. There's no way I'm letting that robotic juiced monkey cut me. Get someone else, please.
You try to sit up, but it's useless. That juice monkey is going to save your life. We can talk about payment later. The woman turns and walks out of the room. Tetsuo squirts a syringe in the air. Don't you dare, you say. He gives you a sad half smile.
You're lucky Ushiro found you, he says, searching for a vein in your limp arm.
That Gashotokuro will be eating at Yomi's hearth tonight.
I don't understand a word you said.
He pokes the needle into your vein and squeezes the clear liquid into your body. You feel nothing.
Yeah, Yoshiro blew that robot away with a percussion grenade.
Your eyes begin to sag, and you can't focus on Tetsuo.
Please, don't take my arm, you say, slurring over your words. I'm just visiting here. This isn't supposed to happen.
His eyes soften, and he smiles. He picks up a robotic arm and presents it to you with both hands. It's black and sleek. A high-tech work of art.
Like Akane said, I'm going to fix you up.
He places the arm on the table. The last thing you see is the big man pulling a saw from his bag. Flex your robotic arm. It responds well. You try giving it an air punch, and it flashes in the candlelight with lightning speed. Getting used to your new arm? You turn to see the woman's cold eyes staring back at you through the dim light. My back, you say, turning your body.
Tetsuo had to replace your spine from the shoulders down. It was broken in more places than he thought.
Replace my spine? But with your technology?
A smile flashes across her face, and she lets out a little huff.
If there's one thing we can do, it's fix people up. Tetsuo is a miracle with cybernetics.
What is this place? An old subway. Don't worry. It's too deep to scan.
Scan?
Even as you say the word, something from your past tells you you already know what it is. You just have to concentrate and remember.
What were you doing up there, wandering around in the streets?
I don't know. I was lost.
Where are you from?
Out of town. A village.
Why did you come to Tokyo? And how did you get in?
I just walked in.
You just walked in?
Yeah. You're lying.
No, it's true. I mean, I was careful.
Tokyo is the computer's lair. Every inch of the city is scanned by satellite day and night. There's an army of robots out there combing the streets, killing anything that moves, anything with hot blood in its veins. A rat can't survive up there.
And you just walked in?
Well, I didn't get too far, did I?
You're either incredibly lucky, or you're a spy. I'm not sure which.
She turns and walks across the room. She picks up some clothes hanging over a chair and hands them to you.
Put these on, she says.
If I was a spy for the robots, I guess you mean, why would they chase me down with a tank? They tried pretty hard to kill me.
Let's just say I don't have a lot of trust anymore. That computer is smart. It's a chess player. So no, I don't trust you. You have to earn my trust.
You reach your good hand along your back. An adhesive bandage runs up its whole length.
Why did you save me? You ask.
Because I'm building an army. You want to pay me back? Kill robots.
She turns and walks out of the room.
The graffitied subway tunnel is lit only by candles mounted in the skulls of robots. They look like jack-o'-lanterns. Young men and women are lying around, bored. Some are playing cards, others holographic video games. All their faces are pocked and scarred from the disease. They're survivors. Cybernetics are as common in this tunnel as ink at a tattoo parlor. A number of the youth are so heavily modded, they hardly look human. Robotic arms, legs, eyes, ears. It seems the more exotic the mod, the more tough or cool they are. They wear leather jackets, fishnets, studs. One has an old Japanese helmet from World War II. Their faces are plastered with makeup. The women wear white foundation and bold red or black lipstick. Their eyeliner is dark, making them look like ghosts in the dim light. Many of the men also wear makeup. Some use it effeminately, copying the women, which gives them a dangerous, unpredictable look. Others wear it like war paint.
Perhaps what's most noticeable are the weapons. These youth are a mobile arsenal. Assault rifles, belts stuffed with percussion grenades, huge hunting knives decorated with streamers and feathers. Some wear more traditional Japanese weapons, katanas and pole staffs. A couple heavily modded young women playing a holographic video game begin to fight over who won. Their robotic arms smash into one another with the force of pneumatic pumps, and their steel bodies dent under the pressure. A small crowd mingles around them, glad to have some distraction from the endless boredom. One of the fighters is knocked down, the flesh side of her face almost ripped right off. She roars with a loud, digital voice that throws you off guard. She pulls out an old-fashioned Magnum handgun and fires it into the chest of the other young woman. She's thrown back into the subway wall. Her leather jacket is shredded, and her torn undershirt catches fire, revealing a dinged metal plate. She swears, leaps up on her robotic feet, and runs to a chest where she pulls out a shotgun. The roar of an engine echoes through the hall. Everyone turns to look. You can see a single spotlight cutting through the darkness. Moments later, a speed bike with what looks like a samurai riding it tears down the subway tracks. He stops and dismounts. His armor is a dark burgundy and looks like it was taken from a museum. He removes his helmet to reveal a handsome face. His scarring looks more like harmless acne than the devastating pox you see on most of the others. And he doesn't seem to have any cybernetics, at least none that you can see. "Where's Akane?" he says, turning off his bike and swinging his leg over. "I'm here," she says. You turn to see her in the shadows, standing under an old imperial Japanese flag. "What's the news?" "The farmer was right," he says. By the way everyone glances in your direction, you realize he's talking about you. "Right? About what?" "That he could walk right into Tokyo. Something's going on up there. Something new." "Come," Akane says, and motions him to follow. She takes the samurai through a door and closes it behind them. You notice Tetsuo standing near you, arms folded over his huge cybernetic chest. "Who is that?" you say. "That was Yoshiro," he spits the word. "What do you see out there?" you ask. Tetsuo's cybernetic eyes are like binoculars, and from this great height, he can probably see all the way to Mount Fuji. "You see that out there, all around the city?" You strain your eyes and can make out a ring of metal shimmering like a mirage in the sun. "I think so. What is it?" "We used to think it was a wall, a big metal cybernetic wall, but it's not." He pauses and looks at you, waiting for a reaction, a guess. "You know what that thing is? It's a particle accelerator." Suddenly all comes together. The Twilight Histories uses a particle accelerator to create a wormhole. It's how you're able to travel through the multiverse. "They've been building it for years. But They've never turned it on until now. It must be interfering with the scans. Normally, we wouldn't be able to survive more than 2 minutes exposed up here in a skyscraper. The computer would pick us up like candles in the dark. But as you can see, we're invisible.
As if to drive the point home, a military helicopter flies right by your window. You can even see the shapes of the robot in the cockpit, looking straight ahead, completely oblivious to you. Tetsuo reaches into his bag and pulls out a bunch of electronics. He begins assembling them.
"What are you making?" you ask.
"A scanner, similar to the one they use. It will tell us if the particle accelerator is on."
He picks up what looks like a hacked TV remote.
"When the light's green, it's safe to come up. When it's red, we stay below."
"I see." You look out at the Tokyo skyline. The massive towers are immaculate, gleaming, perfect. It's strange to think that millions of rotting corpses fill the city. It's a necropolis, a disaster zone. And yet, from this height, it looks perfect, like a monument of human achievement.
Just a question. We won't know when the particle accelerator will turn off?
Sure, when the light's red.
No, what I mean is, we won't know ahead of time.
Ah, I see what you mean. Yeah, I guess you're right. Coming up will be risky.
He shrugs it off and keeps working.
You don't seem too worried about that.
Hey, if they start scanning, we'll be dead before you can snap your fingers.
A tank rumbles down the street below your building. It leaves a bloody trail behind it as it churns the garbage and bodies.
That man, Yushiro, you don't like him, do you?
The sound of Tetsuo's ratcheting suddenly stops. You turn to see him looking at the floor, his eyebrows knotted, his jaw chewing.
What did he do to you? Anything I need to worry about?
He stole a cane from me.
You swallow a laugh before it rolls off your tongue. Tetsuo is practically a machine. He certainly doesn't have the necessary faculties to help a relationship along.
You were with a cane?
Yes. No. I found her. After the virus wars, she was alone. I took her down to the subways.
Ah, so you wanted her, and Yoshiro got her.
His cybernetic eyes twist into something inhuman, menacing. He finishes ratcheting the device on the stand. He holds up the remote. The light is red.
"That's funny," he says, and bangs it against his metal thigh.
"What's funny?" you say.
"Must be broken."
"What do you mean, broken?"
Your heart is pounding and you look outside. A helicopter gunship circles around the next skyscraper over, then disappears behind the glass. You look back at Tetsuo. He's testing his equipment, and you can't help but notice his forehead is covered in sweat.
"It's broken," you say, repeating yourself as though the words will make it true.
"Yes, broken."
He stands and looks out the window.
"We're alive, so it must be broken."
He opens the back of the scanner and scowls. You feel the sickening sensation of walls closing in.
I don't like this," you say. "Let's go."
Hey, I'm just taking a look."
You glance out the window towards the particle accelerator off in the distance. Jets fly over the city. The roar of the helicopter gunship passing by rattles the windows, and you instinctively drop to the ground.
"Are you almost done?" "I just want to check one last thing."
You crawl over to Tetsuo and throw his tools in the bag.
"Hey, relax, farmer. We're okay."
He
I've just got to get used to this. This is Tokyo, not the rice paddies.
Let's go, right now.
Okay, farmer, we'll go.
What do you mean it doesn't work?
Yoshiro says. He stops sharpening his katana and rises from the bench. Tetsuo cowers before Yoshiro, bowing his whole body. It's very strange to see the powerful robotic giant kowtowing to the much smaller man.
I'm not sure. Should work fine, but doesn't.
Well, figure it out, Runt.
Runt is an old nickname Tetsuo earned before he started modding his body. You've only ever heard Yoshiro say it. No one else would be foolish enough to insult the giant.
Let me see,
Kane says, holding out her hand to the remote. Tetsuo smiles at her and presents it with both hands.
The light is green.
Tetsuo looks at it, puzzled.
What? That's funny.
What's funny?
Well, it was red when we were up there.
Very strange. Must be more broken than I thought.
You fool, it's not broken,
Kane says.
Huh, if it worked fine, me and the farmer here would be dead by now. There were gunships all over us.
There's a rumbling in the ground. You can feel it in your gut.
They didn't kill you because they were following you. You led them right to us.
The earthquake is coupled with the distinct sound of engines and the clank, clank, clank of tank treads echoing from deep in the black pit of the subway tunnel. You turn around. The same sounds rumble from the other side, too.
Nyoro naro koi,
Yoshiro says, and leaps down into the tracks, sword at the ready. The other young men and women follow him, unlocking their weapons and shouting curses.
We can't fight them! Not like this, Kane says.
The makeshift group looks confused, their allegiance shifting between the honor of fighting and the disgrace of retreat. Yoshiro's face is unbroken, determined. He snaps his mask down as though to drive the point home.
Yoshiro! This has all happened before, just like this, Kane says.
There was no fight, just a slaughter. Everyone died except me, Yoshiro.
We'll fight them, but on our own terms, not like this.
Yoshiro sways back and forth, slowly, like a cat ready to pounce. Tetsuo leaps down onto the tracks and turns on his railgun. The chambers spin, ready to spew out iron death.
Tetsuo! Not you two! Come, we'll fight another day. Please, all of you!
Kane is cut off by a series of rapid explosions that rip through the young men and women. Blood and fire blasts into your face, blinding you. You instinctively turn and run. Akane grabs your arm.
This way, she says.
There are screams behind you, but they're quickly drowned out by more explosions. You're in a sewer. The water has long since run dry, and even the human waste has lost its smell. You feel like you're in the arteries of the city, but those arteries are empty, without blood. The city is a dry, mummified body, a mirage of life, a zombie, a machine. Where are we going? You say after what seems like hours.
Someplace safe, she says.
Do you think they're all dead?
Yes.
Is there anyone else? Anyone else in Tokyo? Yes, but they're of no use to us.
What do you mean?
She turns to you, and her candle lights up a face that could be a demon's. Because their minds are gone, she says, and hovers there a moment. Maybe her own mind is gone. You're in a cellar. It's covered in thick cobwebs. Shelves are lined with cans of food. There are some old magazines sitting on a table. What is this place?
An old safe house, she says, and begins brushing away the cobwebs. Her movements are forceful, angry.
You pick up one of the magazines.
Chess? Are these yours?
She doesn't respond.
You got any music down here?
She says something under her breath that you can't hear.
Sorry, what was that?
I said, shut up.
Sorry.
Don't bother.
She starts breathing hard and looks like she could cry. Then she stands up straight, breathes deeply, and continues to clear away the cobwebs. You've read all the chess magazines back to front, even the ads. Boring stuff. The translator chip in your brain easily deciphers the kanji. You're about to break open a can of peaches when the door bursts open. The dark shape of a man stands in the doorway. You leap back and Akane picks up a gun.
Wait, don't shoot.
Yoshiro?
Yes.
He steps into the torchlight, his armor shredded with bullet holes and pieces of shrapnel. Blood seeps through the cracks.
You're hurt.
Yes. Akane runs to him, and he falls into her arms. She pulls off his armor, revealing a thick, muscled body, no cybernetics, and it's littered with wounds.
Get the first aid kit, farmer. It's on the top shelf.
Akane nurses him back to health. You don't know how long it takes, but judging by your sleep cycles, it might be a week, maybe even two. In that time, you learn that the fight had indeed been a massacre. Yoshiro was thrown by an explosion onto the tarmac. Stunned and hurt, he could only watch as his friends were engulfed by flames and bullets. Soon, only Tetsuo remained on the tracks. He looked like one of them, one of the robots. His synthetic skin burned away to reveal a face of metal. His railgun opened up, and he walked, calm, into the tunnel and out of sight. Seeing Tetsuo walk to his death like that made Yoshiro want to follow, but instead he found himself running into the sewers like a coward. Akane holds the remote. The light is green.
Don't worry, she says. You'll get your chance to reclaim your honor.
A great cloud of black birds fly in swirling yawning movements, folding into one another, then separating, turning, and coming together again.
I didn't think there were any birds in Tokyo, you say.
Those aren't birds, Akane says, and hands you the binoculars. Suddenly the birds turn into helicopters and jets, a huge mass of them flying impossibly close to one another. It seems incredible that they don't touch.
That's it. That's the computer's lair, Akane says.
You motion the binoculars down and see a large, windowless building. It's square and looks like it's made of concrete, no paint. Around the building are the piled remains of other buildings that look like they were demolished and bulldozed to the sides to form a crater or perhaps a wall. There are robots moving slowly around the concrete building, like pilgrims circling the Kaaba at Mecca. Tens of thousands, perhaps even hundreds of thousands of corpses are piled around the perimeter, trampled by the feet of the machines. This was the last army to attack the computer, the climax of the virus wars. Yoshiro looks at his watch.
It's been 34 minutes, he says. We should go.
Wait. She takes the binoculars back from you. You can almost hear the seconds tick by on Yoshiro's wrist.
There's no other way. We have to walk in.
You and Yoshiro look at each other.
Walk in, he says.
She turns with a flash of anger.
I've run enough. How are you feeling?
Yoshiro looks embarrassed.
We walk in.
She slowly puts the binoculars up to her eyes.
It's time to send in the queen.
You're startled by Yoshiro and Akane. Even though you're fully aware their masks are hollowed-out robot faces, they still shock you. Akane wears a trench coat and a hat. Yoshiro keeps his armor. You wear a mishmash of clothes, a death metal t-shirt under a woman's red leather jacket. A wide-brimmed hat hides the back of your head. Akane explains that these costumes are suitable. The robots often wear human clothes to help them get just a little closer to their prey. Now you'll do the same to the robots.
Iku,
Yoshiro says and rises. Akane rises next and puts on her backpack, which holds a bomb, then grabs her rifle. They both look back at you.
This is a suicide mission, right?
You say.
We're going to die anyways, Yoshiro says.
You're terrified to join them, but the thought of being on your own in this nightmarish world seems even more terrifying. And it's true, the computer will eventually find you and kill you.
Okay, I'm coming, you say.
You step out into the street. The sun is setting, but it's still hot. You're sweating under your mask. You don't make it half a block before you're approached by a robot. A sickening idea suddenly comes over you. If it's just one central computer and all these robots are extensions of it, wouldn't it instantly know you're not one of them? You sweat as the robot draws near. It lowers its gun and looks at you, then raises it and continues on its way. There are robots and military vehicles everywhere, and the closer you get to the concrete building, the more human bodies litter the ground. They're piled up on the shoulders of the road like snowbanks. Down the center of the road, the bodies have been ground down by tanks and trucks, making a sickening, goopy mud that sucks and pulls at your sandaled feet. You see a transport vehicle stuck in the gore up to the axles. Robots are pushing on the bumper as the wheels spin, spraying them with gore. You've seen plenty of horrific scenes on your many journeys, but you know you'll see this scene again in your nightmares. You enter the clearing, and there's the swarm. Helicopters and jets dash through the sky like angry bees after their hive has been smashed. It's mesmerizing, and you think almost beautiful. "Don't look at it," Akane whispers to you. "You'll draw attention to us." You snap your head down and look straight ahead. There is the cement building, and around it are the walls of bodies and debris. "I haven't been here since the virus wars," Yoshiro says. He sounds scared. The street is clogged with armed robots, dressed in a mishmash of fashions. You feel a deja vu, like you're walking the real Tokyo during rush hour. But the robots never touch. They almost seem to have a magnetic rejection to each other, and they file through as though they were one being guided by some algorithm. You enter the cement building. There are no lights, no windows, and you're quickly blinded by the darkness. Your breathing quickens. You have flashbacks of a haunted house you once visited on Halloween. But this is the real thing. You're surrounded by real death machines. Machines that will kill you in a moment. And these machines are covered in the smell of a human abattoir. The halls thin out until at last you round a quiet corner where there are no robots. There are great tall machines on either side of the hall. They have lights, some flickering, some constant. They give off just enough light that you can see Akane and Yoshiro's masked faces. "Good enough," you say. "Can we just drop the bomb and go?" Akane removes her mask. Her eyes are sad. She looks at Yoshiro, and he removes his mask. "What are you two doing? Why are you taking off your masks? Let's just drop the bomb and get out of here." "You go," Akane says. "We're staying here. We have to see this thing through."
"Why can't we just set the timer and run?"
"It's too big a risk. Robot might find the bomb. We have to do it manually, now." You feel flustered, angry. You could get away. "You're not going to kill the computer, you know that, right? You're just going to piss it off. It'll have to build this thing all over again, and how long will that take? A month? A year? So you're willing to kill yourselves, to what? Guarantee the computer's pissed off?" Kane doesn't even look at you. She flips a panel on the bomb. "This is revenge," she says. "It may only stall the computer, but it has to be done. For the sake of all those who died, this is how the virus wars end." You step away, frustrated. "It doesn't actually feel anything, you know. And it won't get pissed off. I lied. It sees the world in zeros and ones. It's a computer." You don't have to stay, she says. You look at Yoshiro. Go, he says. We'll hold off as long as we can. Tell others what we did here.
Well, well, comes a voice down the hall. You recognize this voice. It's Tetsuo. Akane and Yoshiro swing on their heels. Runt, is that you? Yoshiro says. Tetsuo growls. Put your weapons down. Come with me.
What are you doing here? Akane says.
I've come for my prize.
Tetsuo, what are you talking about?
What prize? You, Akane.
Yoshiro spits and growls. He raises his sword and steps in front of Akane.
You're a traitor!
Maybe, maybe not. Truth is, I'm slightly more machine than human, so it depends on your perspective.
I trusted you, says Akane. Why are you doing this?
The computer made me an offer. If I capture you, I can keep you.
The computer has rewired your brain, Runt, Yoshiro says.
Tetsuo roars and runs out of the darkness. The first thing you notice is that his body and face are covered in skin. He tackles Yoshiro and presses him to the ground.
I don't know why I didn't do this earlier. It's like fighting a toddler.
Yoshiro flails and kicks, but the giant robotic Tetsuo is as heavy as a truck. He raises his fist and is about to slam it down. Yoshiro manages to slip an arm free. His sword is a flash in the dim light, and Tetsuo's clenched fist clunks on the ground. His stub of a wrist sparkles with electronics.
Bastard, he says, and brings the stub down on Yoshiro's helmet.
The old antique dents, and Yoshiro goes limp. Akane fires her rifle in Tetsuo's chest. He leaps off Yoshiro and smacks the rifle away. He grabs her arm.
You're mine now, he says.
I'll never love you, she says. There's a swishing sound, and you see Yoshiro's sword crack in half on the ground between Tetsuo's legs. The giant cyborg looks down at the broken blade and laughs. A drip of blood runs down Tetsuo's forehead. He stops laughing. A cut appears down the center of his nose. The blood drips out of a split lip and then from his chin.
No,
he says. Then his body falls apart right down the center. It clatters into two pieces. Yoshiro stands between the two parts, holding his broken sword. Blood pours down his forehead from a wound under his helmet.
We'd better blow this place up and fast. No time for you to run, I'm afraid, farmer. We've got to do it now.
The sound of a machine gun fills the hall, and Yoshiro's stomach explodes. His legs stand motionless long after his shredded upper body lands on the ground. In the darkness, at the other end of the hall, you see two red lights. A robot.
Akane? You say.
No answer. She's gone. The robot steps into the light.
Come with me, it says.
The robot brings you to a room similar to the one at the Twilight Histories, but more primitive. There are no slick white wall coverings to hide the electronics and machinery. The raised platform is unpainted and raw. There are robots working at various tasks in the room, but none look at you. Only the robot with the gun seems to care that there's a human in the room. "Step on the platform," the robot says. You obey. It steps up with you, holding its gun level to your gut. The room fills with light, and you feel that strange sensation you've become so accustomed to. You feel nauseous and dizzy. The sound of strange, unworldly humming fills your ears. You feel yourself losing consciousness, and you're afraid what the robot will do if you fall. It's your last thought. There's water in your lungs. You're suddenly very conscious, and you flail your arms and legs violently, trying to get your head above water. It's muddy and dark, and you can't see more than an inch in front of your nose. You manage to get your feet into the mud and push yourself up. The water was only waist deep, and you gasp for breath. You become aware of your senses, one by one. First, you're breathing. The air is oxygen-rich and almost makes you high, like you've had too much caffeine. It's also humid and hot, even more so than Tokyo, and you feel like you're breathing in the steam from a boiling kettle. The sounds around you are full and rich and very foreign. Chirps and buzzes and long, warbled humming and popping. You feel heavy, very heavy, as though your body was covered in sandbags. You lift your arms and rub your eyes with hands that must be 20 pounds each. The sting of the water dissipates, and you look around for the first time. You're in a swamp. There are massive white flowers rising from the water and what look like fleshy cow tongues drooping from them. There are strange flying insect-like creatures, fist-sized and covered in fur. A cow tongue swats at one and it screams as some kind of poison or perhaps an electric shock stuns it. The tongue curls around the creature and pulls it into its mouth. Around the swamp is a thick foliage, but it's not green. It's yellow, mostly, with splashes of red, pink, and indigo. Great, long, wet tendrils that look like elephant tails dip into the water. They move around, searching for food. A family of strange beaver-like creatures crawl out of the water and dash into the foliage. You only catch a short glimpse of their long, thick quills. They were brown in the water, but quickly turn bright yellow to match the foliage. You look up at the burning, hot sky. You have to shade your eyes. Two stars, one bright white, the other larger and red. A crescent moon, as big as a house, hovers in the thick, rich, indigo atmosphere. You turn and see the robot standing waist deep in the water. Behind it, the wormhole is still open. And through it, you can see the hazy shapes of robots working. There's a boom, and flames burn your face. You grab your eyes and jump underwater. When you rise, the wormhole is gone. Akane must have blown the place up, and herself with it. The robot raises its machine gun, and you feel your heart sink into your stomach. "No, wait," you say, but it's too late. The muzzle flashes. You stand there for a terrifying moment in a state of shock. You look down, but there are no bullet holes. You pat your body. No blood on your hands. Then you turn around. You see a huge, round mouth full of serrated teeth just inches from your face. You let out a scream. Then, on closer inspection, you notice green goop flowing out of bullet holes. The worm-like creature curls in on itself and, with a sigh, sinks into the water. You turn back to the robot. Aren't you going to kill me? No, it says. You are Project Lise.
Hi, I'm Jordan Harbour. Thanks for listening to the Twilight Histories. I'd like to thank Cryochamber for the rich, dark ambient music you heard in this show. I'll post links in the show notes on the Twilight Histories website. If you enjoyed this show, you'll be happy to know there's a bonus track for this episode. 1,000 years have passed. You are wandering the wastes of the ancient United States. You come to a strange city known as the Celestial Kingdom. They have uncovered a computer, an object of mythological terror. Have a listen to this sample.
She bursts out laughing. Trust me, I wouldn't want any more than one husband. Yeah, but I don't know. It seems like he gets his own personal harem, and you get nothing. He gets all the power and the pleasure. Men dominate here. Now she turns to you with annoyance. No, you've got it wrong. We're lucky. Women are lucky. All women enter the Celestial Kingdom, but only a handful of men get in. The rest are doomed. I wouldn't want to be born a man, and I pity my young boys who will one day be sent out into the wilderness. You're going to exile your own children? And another thing, men don't dominate us. Look around you. Do you see any women who look dominated to you? Look at them. She points to a woman holding a grenade launcher over her shoulder. No, they certainly don't. Men are the heads of the clans, yes. That's how Joseph Smith, in his divine wisdom, dictated it. But women run everything. And we have the guns. This is a city where men and women live in perfect harmony, balanced by the guiding light of the one true God.
You can find the rest of this show on the website by going to twilighthistories.com and clicking on the store. When you purchase a time travel adventure, you are supporting the show, so please go to the website at twilighthistories.com and click on the store. I'm Jordan Harbour. Thanks for listening to the Twilight Histories. Until next time, take care.
You've been listening to the Twilight Histories with Jordan Harbour.
This podcast is part of the Dark Myths Collective. Visit darkmyths.org. to discover more shows like this one, the darkness awaits.